If you haven't had the pleasure of meeting Job yet, I hope you have a chance to do that at some point. Job is a remarkable character in the Bible. He is fascinating. I got to meet Job somewhere in my teens. I don't remember when, but it was at a point in my life where I was pretty much trying to get as far away from God as I could. Actually, I was trying to convince myself that God didn't exist, and yet at the same time, I wanted to believe that I was wrong. And a friend of mine introduced me to Job. Job and I hang out. I don't know if it was at a party or if I was alone in my room. I was flipping through the book. I don't know how I met Job, but somewhere along the way, he and I became friends. And Job has this remarkable way of orienting himself towards God. Job is a faithful man. He is defiantly faithful to God. He puts all of his hope and his trust in God. Now, we get a glimpse of Job in our reading for today, Job chapter 19. And in that reading, which is only four and like another half of a verse, it's really, really short. But in that reading, you may have heard a line that might be more familiar to you. Job says, "For I know that my Redeemer lives." Now, for you and I who hang out in houses like this, we might start thinking of a particular hymn which actually has the exact same title. "For I know that my Redeemer lives." And so now we're starting to think about Jesus and salvation and all those sorts of things that all floods into our head. And here's where I am going to be, Pastor Josh, and tell you that that's not what Job meant. In fact, Job, when he says Redeemer, he's not thinking of Jesus. He's not even thinking of a messianic power, a person who is sent and anointed by God to speak on our behalf and to do great and wonderful things in this world and to save God's people. Job is thinking about redemption in the sense that he's thinking about vindication. That word can actually be translated either way. He wants someone to come along and speak on his behalf against his adversary. In fact, Job is so upset with his adversary that he would like his words to be chiseled in stone like a grave marker so that even if Job were to die, his words would live on and his Redeemer would come along and speak his words against his adversary so that Job's witness would still be borne out. So now we're wondering, who could Job be so mad at? Job's adversary is God. So how did Job get to that point? We go back to chapter 1, we find out in the first few verses, Job is doing all right for himself. Even for 2,500 to 3,000 years ago, we don't know when this story was written. By the way, Job is not a real character. I just want to put it out there that he is a fictional character. But just because the story isn't true doesn't mean that there aren't great truths about our relationship with God buried in this story. This story bears a lot of fruit. Job is doing just fine. In fact, Job is doing so fine that it's actually quite exceptional. We could even say excessive. That the author is trying to make the point, he is setting the baseline for Job early of everything that is going on in Job's life. Job has 3,000 sheep and like 500 oxen and 500 donkeys, and he's got a whole house full of family, of kids, and people bouncing around. He has everything. He has fields that extend beyond the horizon. This is the level of where Job is at in his identity with God. And it's important for us to know, not the specifics, but this is where he starts. We also find out right away, Job is deeply faithful. Job loves God. Job shows up every Sunday morning for worship, even when he's not feeling that great. He makes all the sacrifices that he's supposed to make towards God. Job throws parties for his friends. He gives himself away to his neighbors. Job's that guy. Job loves God. And then in chapter 1 in verse 13, like right away, everything about his life starts to fall apart. He loses his sheep, he loses his oxen, he loses his donkeys, he loses his camels, basically all the critters. They're all gone. And then a wildfire comes along and burns up all of his crops. His entire harvest is now gone. And then tragedy upon tragedy, all of his children are in the same house when the story tells us the roof collapses and they are all dead. Everything about Job's life comes to an end. Every measure and marker of his identity in God is all gone. And Job finds himself sitting in a pile of ash. He pours ash over himself. He tears his clothes and he wails and he cries out to God, which you and I can understand. And one of the things about Job that we might trip ourselves up on is we might convince ourselves that Job's suffering and his pain and his lament is justified because he's lost so much, but I have not lost quite that much, so maybe my suffering does not need to be quite so bad. The author of Job is trying to remind us that whatever we lose in our lives that helps us feel stable, a spouse, a child, a deeply held friend, a job, a house, a car, our place in the community, whatever it is that we lose, where we suddenly become unstable, where we feel separated from God somehow, our suffering is our suffering, and we feel as if we are in a pile of ash. Job's in a pile of ash. He's pouring it upon his head. He has nowhere to go. He's not sure what his next step will be, but he is mired in his suffering and in his pain and in his disappointment. And then suffering upon suffering piles upon him. Still, one last thing happens. He becomes so ill that his body breaks out in sores, and they are so painful that he uses pot shards to scrape and relieve himself. Job is at the very bottom of the well. On those days where you and I find ourselves at the very bottom of the well in the midst of our suffering, and we are not quite sure what we are going to do next, where we are going to turn next. And Job holds on to his relationship with God, somehow, in some way, that barely even makes sense. Word gets out that Job is suffering, and his three friends come. His three beloved friends. His friends find out, and so they come to the farm. And they're out on that county road, and they look down the lane. It's about a quarter, half mile down. And they can see the ash, and they can see all the harvest has been burned away. Maybe they can still see the dead critters out in the field. They can see all of it. And they can see a guy out in the field somewhere, sitting in the ash. They can't believe it's Job. And there again, like you and I, when we get into those moments where we are so wrapped in our pain and our anguish and our suffering that even our neighbors and our friends can't recognize us, they can't see Job for who he is, but they believe it's him. They've checked their GPS, Google Maps says this is the farm, so they walk down the lane. And they get down there, and they find Job sitting in this ash. And here is where his friends become one of the most remarkable signs of compassion that you will find anywhere in the Bible. Anywhere. I will put up almost any other story against what these three friends do. What they do when they find their friends sitting in the ash is that they tear their clothes. They sit in the ash. They pour ash over their heads. They hold him. They lament. They cry out on his behalf, and they say nothing. They just sit with him. They dwell with him. They allow his suffering to become their suffering. They become communion with their brother. You and I, and so many in our lives, we have this temptation that we need to say something. We got to come up with something. Or maybe we got to find that great devotional book to give somebody who's in the midst of their suffering. Or maybe we got to find that perfect Bible verse at that perfect moment. And we wish it would come. And maybe sometimes, Job's friends say, maybe we don't need all that. Maybe all we need to do is just sit and cry and allow the pain to be our pain. Chapter 3, Job starts to talk, and Job starts saying words about God that might make us a little bit uncomfortable, at least when we're doing really good in our relationship with God. Job starts saying words that are kind of devastating. They're a little hard. They're hard for us to hear. They might cause us to push back a little bit, which is actually what happens with Job's friends. Now that Job is talking, Job's friends feel like, well, now we've got free license to talk, which is really unfortunate for Job, because then they start talking. And when they start talking, they start telling Job, you got to be quiet, Job. Look at what happened in your life. If you keep saying these angry words against God, the God who you love, it's only going to get worse, Job. Job's friends, chapter after chapter, they're almost like WWE wrestlers. I mean, they're tag team, one after the other, chapter after chapter, verse after verse. They keep going with the same argument against Job. They keep telling Job, maybe you did something wrong, and God's testing you. Maybe God is trying to tell you something, Job. Maybe, man, maybe you shouldn't have said the thing that you just said, because now that's why your animals are dead, Job. They are connecting suffering with our sinful nature. You and I in this particular house, we love to banter around the phrase saint and sinner. That's how we will describe ourselves or just about anybody else. And sometimes we will lean heavily on the saint side. You know, we're forgiven, we're good. Jesus got the cross thing taken care of. So, yeah, we're going to mess up, but Jesus got us taken care of. Sometimes we'll lean really heavily on the sin side where we know we're broken. We know we keep messing up. And maybe our lives are falling apart because we are sinful people and we rack ourselves with grief and guilt and shame. That's what Job's friends are doing. They're trying to convince Job because they have it convinced in their own head that his suffering has to do with his sinful nature, that he brought it on himself. Now, of course, there is suffering in our world that is brought about by sin. Ask our African-American brothers and sisters where they were enslaved in this country until 1865, when they were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, and yet then because of Reconstruction and Jim Crow laws, that freedom was short-lived, and even today that freedom is short-lived because of powers and oppressions that exist in this world. That is sin creating suffering upon others. Ask our LGBTQ brothers and sisters. Ask our elderly. Ask anybody who has been told that they are unworthy or that they deserve the life that they have been given simply because of how they exist. That is our sinful nature creating suffering upon others. But this is not what Job's friends are talking about. They are saying that Job has done it to himself. And Job knows better. Job knows this isn't how it's supposed to go in our relationship with God, when God loves us and when God cares for us, because God cares for all of creation. That does not immediately imply that God is going to just start piling more suffering upon our lives until we get it. Job will even stand up in the face of his friends and tell them, no, this is not what God does. Suffering is separate from our sinful nature. But that doesn't take away the questions. And Job's got questions. He's got a mountain of questions, chapters worth of questions that he's thrown at God. They all mainly revolve around this question he asks in chapter 21. Why do the wicked live on, reach old age, and grow mighty in power, God? The question that Job is asking is, does our faith, our relationship with God, does it matter in this world? Does it matter that we know God and know God's a loving God, a faithful God, and generous God? If for us, that's great. For our neighbor, it doesn't matter because they're still successful and they've still got all the sheep and they've got all the cattle and they've got all the oxen and the donkeys. They got to keep all theirs. And we didn't. There is suffering in this world. There is pain in this world. There is brokenness in this world. Does it matter that God hears our prayers? All Job wants is to talk to God. All Job wants in all of these questions that he asks is he just wants the audience of God. He wants to speak to God. Maybe he wants to confront God, get a little aggressive with God. He just wants to talk to God. He wants to say his piece in the presence of God. He even knows that when you stand in the presence of God, that is a dangerous thing to do because God is God. But Job wants it. And Job keeps asking for it while he's also pushing away his friends. Which gets us to the very end of the story. And at the very end of the story, God shows up. God shows up in a whirlwind. That's what my translation says. Maybe yours says that at home as well. But you and I, we're good Midwestern folk. We know what a whirlwind is. It's a tornado. God shows up. And this is God. So, of course, this is an F5 tornado that's coming to plow down through the horizon, comes right to the feet of Job. F5 tornado with all the wind and all the devastation, and God is there, and God starts talking to Job, and Job stands up and talks to God, and they confront each other, and they speak honestly, brutally, honestly to each other. God starts making the argument, starts asking Job, are you the one, Job? Are you the one who set the stars, the moon, and the sun up in the sky? Were you the one who set the planetary orbits of our solar system? Job, are you the one who decided where the land goes, where the water goes? Are you the one who made the Leviathan that swims in the ocean and all the great sea creatures? Are you the one, Job? Are you the one who knows how all of this works? Now, on one hand, when you and I read this, when we hear that, maybe even now, that sounds like God's getting a little defensive. like God is hiding in the whirlwind, that God's kind of keeping some distance and pushing Job away. There's also another aspect to this argument. God is telling Job, you don't have to be in charge. There is some relief in knowing that God is God, that even when we don't have all the answers, even when we can't have all the visions, even when our life is surrounded in mystery, that God is still there, that God is listening, that God is working, that God is loving. God responds to Job, the same God who in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, gives us light and dark, the same God who can set the sun and the stars and the moon up in their courses and sets the planetary structure and all that kind of stuff. That same God who can do all of that with a breath, with a single word, is the same God who comes to us and hears us and loves us and cares for us and feeds us and nourishes us and sits in the dirt with us in the midst of our pain. And we may not get all of the answers. We may not get all of the resolution that we need, but we know that God does not give up on us. Now, God in this whirlwind, this F5 tornado, then turns on Job's friends and tells them, y'all are wrong. There is no connection between suffering and your sinful nature. That is not how I work. Now you need Job to pray for you, which Job, because he's such a great guy, he does it right away, prays for his friends. And then there's this really odd ending. It's really strange. But at the very end, last verses, God gives back everything that Job lost. In fact, God doubles down and doubles everything. This does not mean that when we lose our job, when we lose our car, when we lose our spouse, when we lose our loved one, when we are racked in pain, that immediately we will receive back what we have lost. What the author of Job is trying to tell us is that we know how Job started. And we know how he fell into that pit of despair and suffering that was so deep that he could not find his way out. But because he was encountered by God, because God came to him in a form and spoke to him in words that Job could hear, Job was restored. Job was reminded that God's love was with him the entire time. Job is redeemed. Now for Job, his redemption comes through getting all the critters back and getting his family back and getting the harvest back and all those things that reset his life. For you and me, our redemption comes through God, who loves us so deeply that he will walk among us and give us flesh and bone just like us and will die just like us, so that there is nothing that can separate us from the love of God. We find our restoration through water. We find our restoration through meals. We find our restoration through a community that will sit in the dirt with us for as long as it takes, so that we can hear again God's love for us. Our lives are full of mystery. We don't get to have all the answers, but we have God, and God's got us. And God listens to us, and God comes to us, God responds to us, and God loves us in the midst of our suffering, to hear again that God's love and redemption is so profound that God will not let us go. Amen.